Broadcasting worldwide on internet radio.
Refreshing takes on legal strategies.
Straightforward answers to difficult tax questions.
Independent ideas on building wealth. The Refresher Wealth Show with Mark Kohler and Matt Sorensen.
Previously recorded with Mark as the host of The Mark Kohler Show.
Enjoy this fresh take on strategies to better live the American dream.
Welcome, everybody, to today's show. My name is Mark Kohler, your host. Excited to be here with you on another Mark Kohler Show. Gosh, I said my name twice there, but I'm excited to be here with you. Welcome to the new listeners. This is a show all about tax and legal, estate, asset protection planning, where I bring on some experts in our law and accounting firm, and I myself try to do my best in pointing you in the right direction, playing quarterback, and giving you ways to better make money, protect it, and live that American dream. It's such an honor to be here with you. It's so fun. This is truly one of my happiest times of the week is being here on the show with you. And I want to thank many, many of you that listen via podcast, those live listeners that are on today. We also have Lisa Owens in the studio filtering calls and just doing an awesome job behind the scenes making it all happen. And I'm grateful to be here with you. I'm hoping again to have a kind of a new format for the show, maybe even a new title for the show, kind of freshen it up. It's been, gosh, over 5 years every week. If you're a new listener, please go back and listen to some of the older podcasts on iTunes or in Blog Talk Radio. There's so many amazing guests I've had over the years. It's been such a wonderful ride. But it is time for a little update. So we're going to be doing some maybe different approach to the show, some new music, some giveaways, some questions, and I think it's going to be fun. So that should be hopefully here in the next few weeks. Today's show, also, I've got to give a big shout out to Bill in Hawaii. He's so funny. I think he's started to realize this is really a family business, a family process here where some of my typos, I should say this to all of you in the newsletters and in the emails, we really are a tax and a law firm here trying to provide some marketing and education, which is quite unique in this industry. And so, yes, you're going to see some mistakes where we don't have a corporate 500 floor of people triple checking everything before it goes out. So I want to tell all of you, thank you for your patience as we try to spread the good word, share the information. And if you do have an edit, as Bill finds, we're going to bring him on full time as our email editor because he knows his stuff. So Bill, thanks for your patience and everyone out there with our emails and the newsletters. We've got an exciting newsletter that did go out though. Some great topics. I was excited to highlight some of the states that are taxable and non-taxable. Matt Sorensen talks about the limited partnership. There's also some strategies there on the dining and entertainment. I want you to check out that article. Some fun videos, a video on making sure you hire your kids before year end, and also a little fly fishing video from Arkansas. I was down with the good people of the Work Camper organization and RV Inspector group, RV Connection, Steve and Terry down there. It was just such Steve Anderson, Terry Cooper. I was just so amazed with the warmth and kindness of the folks of the South and all these full-time RV business owners. It was just a wonderful time. So I did a little fly fishing with my son, and that was last week, and I shot a little video there. So Dylan edited up something. So if you get a chance on the newsletter, watch that video. It's kind of fun. Now, today, a couple more announcements, but I'll do those in a little bit. But today, of course, is going to be the Open Forum Show Part 2. Last week, I had such an onslaught of wonderful, amazing questions and such a response from our listeners that I said, I can't wait another month to answer these questions. We're going to do back-to-back shows. I'll announce my guest for next week, who's an amazing speaker and author, and we're really excited to have her on the show next week. I'll announce that here a little bit later. But today, we're just going to stick with you. This is a show all about you. Hopefully some questions that if you're just listening in, some questions that will affect you in your life. As you know, I try to twist the question into a general preposition so that everybody gets something out of these this discussion. So lots of questions here in the hopper, but we're going to still do our tax and legal tip for today and try to get some general tips out there from some experiences our professionals have had in the office. So I'm going to bring out Brian Brown first. Brian Brown is a CPA, a very seasoned CPA. I say that in all the with the nicest of intent, and he is our partner here at Kohler & Ayer CPAs, and he keeps us all in check and a regular contributor to the show. Brian, welcome.
Once again, you call me old. Fine.
I said seasoned.
Yeah, exactly. What's the difference?
Salt and peppered. Something. Yeah,
exactly. So, unfortunately, it's more salt than peppered at this point.
Yeah, there you go. Well, you're awesome. Thanks so much for finding some time to come on the show. We sure appreciate it. Well, tell us, what kind of experience did you maybe have this week with a little tip for us?
Well, you've already stole my thunder, actually, in the opening, but I'm still going to discuss it anyway.
Okay.
Paying your kids. I want to talk about that a little bit because, again, like you said, let's get them on the payroll before the end of the year. I've actually had two tax consults today. This morning about paying their kids.
I did too. I actually had one myself. This is the topic of the year. I mean, time of the year. Yeah, good point.
And so, one of them has an S corporation, so we need the family management company. Another one just had a Schedule C, a sole proprietorship. Don't know if they're quite ready for an S corporation because of taxable income issues. And so, again, we said, no, you don't need an S. You don't need a separate family management company because it's right off your sole proprietorship, so it can take right off your Schedule C. So that's one thing I wanted to look at was, number one, if you have an S-Corp, you're going to need that family management company to pay those kids under 18. Number two, if you don't have an S-Corp, you can pay them right off your single-member LLC. If it's a LLC that's owned by multiple members, as long as it's husband and wife, still pay them right out of that LLC. If we have an LLC that's owned by two separate individuals that aren't husband and wife, then you're going to need that family management company. The other thing that
Something if I could. I know someone out there is scratching their head going, what in the heck is a family management company? Yeah. So let me just mention, Brian, if you add to this, but it's a sole proprietorship. You could go down to any bank. You don't even need a DBA if your family name is in the company name. Most banks will allow you to set up a small business bank account, Kohler Family Management, for example, and you can do it under your Social Security number, but it's just a little sole proprietor that you would funnel the money to the kids through. So that would be the entity, if you will, that would be hiring the kids. So if you have a corporation or a multi-member LLC, you transfer funds to that entity and then pay the kids.
Yep, absolutely correct. And the other point I wanted to bring out on this was the amount of money to pay your kids. You know, you need to make sure your kids are able to do work and actually do work for the business. I had one consult this morning where they've got a child who is disabled. So, again, they're not going to be able to quite do as much and probably may not be able to get the full $5,900, $6,000 that we recommend that you can pay your children under 18. But again, so you need to kind of gauge that. You know, you're not going to be able to pay a 3-year-old what you're going to pay a 17-year-old. You know, they're not going to be able to do things. There's, you know, very limited things that certain children can do. So be sure and gauge that. You know, don't just say, oh, I'm going to pay my, 3-year-old the maximum amount because, if there's an audit, the IRS is going to say, okay, what'd they do? You know, we want to be able to do these things properly in the proper format. So if that auditor comes, we don't have a problem. Hey, here you go, dude.
I love it. Great topic to bring up. If I could interject just two last points, and then I'll ask you to summarize. We've got a lot of questions in the hopper here for open forum. But I would just say for many of you out there that go, I don't have kids under age 18, no matter if you're what your kid's age may be, if they're over age 18 and you're helping support a family member, think 1099. Make sure they're playing a role, maybe as at least as a board of director, as on the management committee, or they're helping with marketing or property management or something. But if you are helping your kids, even over age 18, or even a parent or a brother or sister or niece or nephew, grandchild, use the 1099 strategy. And my second point would be the next 8 weeks is the time to get this done. You want to make sure you document what they did during the year 2014, write them a check, funnel the money back to yourself as a reimbursement if you need to, but make sure the money passes to the children through the proper entity, and you can generate this tax deduction legitimately before the end of the year. So it's the timing couldn't be more critical. So any final words, Brian, on this point too as well?
Nope, that's it. You did a great job of summarizing it, Mark.
Well, I appreciate you bringing up the topic. I suspect we may even have a question on the open forum on it, and I'll just direct them back to this opening statement. So there you go. Brian Brown, the myth, the legend. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks. Take care, Mark.
All right, take care. All right, now we've also got Lee Chen on the line. He is an attorney as well, and he is in the California office, running our operations here for the law firm out of Irvine. So I will grab Lee here for a moment, and hopefully he can come out and share a thought or experience, a little tip for us from the legal point of view. Lee, welcome to the show.
Yes, here I am, Mark. Thanks for having me on again.
Well, thank you. How did Halloween treat you?
It was quiet. You know, with a six-month-old, you can't do very much. So we tried to avoid all the trick-or-treating rush and just had a quiet night out to dinner.
I like it. Well, folks, if you don't know, his little six-month-old was dressed up as a pea pod, and it was adorable. So fun stuff. That's a great age. Easy to control on Halloween night. I had teenagers going every direction. So good stuff. Well, what type of tip have you got for us today?
Well, before I get to the tip, I wanted to piggyback off what you were talking about before about paying the kids over 18. I just had a client who is implementing one of our strategies. He pays for his kids' tuition for college by hiring his kids to do marketing, IT, and he's essentially getting a deduction for paying his kids' tuition. So just an example of one way you can use that strategy, you know, that thinking outside the box.
Mm-hmm. I like it. I like it. Very good comment. I'm glad you threw that out there. Again, college tuition bills are being paid all over the country right now. So good comment.
Yeah, if there's a way you can get that deduction. So, but today what I wanted to talk about was an asset protection issue, especially when we have a lot of people who are setting up their structure for 2015, and we always recommend that, you know, you implement these asset protection and protection mechanisms before some issue comes up. And so I wanted to talk about something you bring up in your book regarding partnerships who are running an operations business. In your book, you recommend what we call the LLC S-Corp combo. And a lot of times we talk about that, having an LLC be the entity for the partnership who's doing all the partnership business, but then having each of the individual partners own the LLC, their 50% share, for example, through their S-Corp. And that way they can also get the tax savings from the S-Corp. And so that's something that you discuss in the appendix of your CPA book. And we talk about it a lot in terms of tax savings, but something that may not always be mentioned about that is that double layer of asset protection that you have when you have that LLC S-Corp combo. We recently had a case come in where there was a partnership using the LLC. One of the partners was owned by their S-Corp, which is what we recommend. The other partner was owned by the person individually. And this LLC partnership entered into a long-term lease. They weren't able to pay the lease, And now they are suing the LLC, but because they want to go after the personal assets, they are trying to pierce the corporate veil of that LLC to get at the individual partners.
And one of the partners had an S-corp and one didn't. And the one that did not have the S-corp in that structure is got a little more of they're sweating a few more bullets.
We're having to do the whole argument for the piercing of corporate veil. So, Mark, I know you got blog articles on things you need to think of, you know, to prevent from piercing the corporate veil. It's on your website. And we're going to make all those arguments, okay? But if that fails, I mean, we're talking about a long-term lease for about, you know, several hundred thousands of dollars. This one individual who didn't use the S-Corp could be looking at bankruptcy. Whereas the person with the S-Corp is sitting there kind of saying, okay, well, you know, I mean, the worst you can do is get my S-Corp, and you'll have to pierce the corporate veil of the S-Corp as well in order to get at me personally. So there's that double layer. And we usually don't see that being an issue, but we have a particularly aggressive plaintiff who is really trying to really, maximize their settlement position by putting an argument for piercing the corporate veil, even though there probably isn't one existing. But they file a lawsuit, they're going to throw in the kitchen sink, and we just have to deal with it.
I like it. Well, great tip, Lee. And again, the tax purpose of having that S-Corp combo with two partners doing an operational business is, again, so powerful. A lot of times we forget that there's an ancillary asset protection benefit with leases or agreements that the LLC may be entering into. So great tip. Well, Lee Chen, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Anytime, Mark.
All right, folks. If you need to get Lee, you can email him at Lee, L-E-E, at KKOSlawyers.com. And, of course, call on the main number. You can track down any of our expert contributors, Brian Brown or Lee Chen, today. Well, we're going to jump right into some of these questions that we had come in through the show last week and into this week. So lots of little questions here, and I think many of you are going to find some interesting golden nuggets here of information that can help you in your personal life and business. So we're going to go to a 1031 exchange question. This one is from Lane. He says, I have a $450,000 property with $150,000 of equity after sales and commissions. I want to use this to buy 2 to 4 rentals at $70,000 a piece. Could I buy 2 rentals with cash, $140,000, with the 1031 exchange, and then do a cash out refi, pull my equity out, leaving me $50,000 as down payments and $90,000 as the loans? Could I then just spend the $90,000 that I pulled out to go on a killer vacation to take my time to buy a couple other rentals with the $90,000 his down payments, because it would not have to follow the rules of the 1031 regarding timing? Well, tough question. Let me just say this, and I may not be understanding the question entirely, so Lane, we might need to have a little conversation offline. But if you're going to buy the first 2 rentals for cash, $140,000 total, your 1031 would fail, because remember, you have to buy property of equal or greater value than what you sold. So if you buy a property for sell one for $450,000, you've got to buy 2 to 4 rentals of close to $450,000 in total purchase price. That resolves the 1031 strategy. Then, if you want to do some cash out refi on one or more of the properties and go use the money elsewhere, fine. Now, there are cases where folks try to suck equity out too quickly right after a 1031 exchange, and the IRS may say there was a step transaction and the 1031 was only a farce and you just pulled out cash afterwards. So you want to give yourself a little breathing room after you close the 1031. You don't want to pull out cash during the closing of the 1031. That's for sure. That's called boot. and you'd be taxed on that. But keep in mind, you have to buy property of equal or greater value than what you sell. So for anyone out there thinking of a 1031, they're very, very popular right now. Properties have appreciated. We've bounced back from the 2008 crash. And so if you're selling a property and you want to not pay the tax on the gain, roll it to one or more properties of equal or greater value, and it's purchase price for purchase price. A question from Gary. Says, Mark, I have about $25,000 in a previous employer's retirement plan. I have the option to roll it to an IRA, a self-directed IRA. I plan to take out a permanent life insurance policy on myself and would like to use this money to fund the policy. I will ask the insurance company if they would accept the IRA as a policy owner, but from a probated transaction perspective, is this something that my IRA can do? I confirmed this, that we talked about it last week, and I gave an initial thought, and this would be prohibited. The IRA cannot own an insurance plan. And so you would want to roll the $25,000 out to a self-directed IRA and invest it in a project, a piece of real estate, precious metals, a self-directed LLC that's doing some sort of business or hard money loans, whatever, but it could not buy life insurance. Sorry, Gary. And I wanted to confirm that even after last week's topic. Now, let me throw this out. For anybody that wants to call in, live callers get priority here today. And so if you'd like to call in, you can talk to Lisa in the studio, and she will bring you out online. And that's 646-200-4285, 646-200-4285. 4285. If you're concerned I may not get to your question today, you can always expedite the process by calling in. I love to have a live person on the line to talk with, so please feel free to call in. I'm going to jump over to Bill in Hawaii, who has been so much help lately. I'm going to jump ahead to one of his questions today. He said, Mark, I got a foreclosure on a private money deal. There's four positions, four lenders. So there's a first mortgage for X number of dollars, a second position lender, a third position lender, and a fourth position lender that has not even a recorded mortgage. Their loan's not even secured. And the property is going into foreclosure. So he said, I understand if it will go to court for the decision after, you know, it could take some time. What is the process of distributing the settlement of the monies from the sale after selling costs? So the first position gets paid first, and it's principal and interest and penalties that may be in that note. And then the leftover would go to the second position, and then the last part would go to the third position if there's anything left. And it would be, again, principal and interest and penalties. Now, sometimes what you'll see as it goes into foreclosure is that there's sometimes some negotiating going on. The first, second, third, and fourth will get together and say, hey, I'll buy out the first position and I'll give you at least your principal. And the second or third position might jump in and negotiate with the first or a position in front of them and pay them less than principal or interest and penalties just to take their position out. And they may jump on that. They don't want to go through the process of foreclosure. They don't want to pay for the legal fees involved. And they just like to get some money and get out. So those folks that are in second and third position may want to, if they know that the fair market value of the property is in far excess of the first position, they might buy them out and do some haggling behind the scenes. I won't lie to you. I'm not a foreclosure expert by any means. Lee Chan, that was just on the line here with us providing some expert tips, please give him a call and consult with him for at least 15 minutes. I know that he's been in the courts many, many times on foreclosures. It could give you some perspective from his legal experience in the courtroom. So great question, Bill, and I hope my thoughts help to some degree. All right, now we're going to jump over to the chat line. We've got a comment here from Kirby. He said, anyone there an expert in using a specific type of trust for a 1031 called a Delaware Structured Trust. My understanding is that the entity is seen as real property for purposes of the IRS, so multiple people can 1031 out of their existing equity positions and buy shares into a Delaware Structured Trust that can own a bigger property, and this gets around the normal 1031 issue where selling and buying properties have to be the exact same entity name because the buy is done as shares in the new DST. I have Kirby heard of some of these little strategies to finagle around the 1031 rules, if you have an expert, maybe through the web, you find someone that will stand behind it, that is a licensed CPA or an attorney that has malpractice insurance, and that will verify in writing that they will pay the penalties if the 1031 is challenged, go for it. As long as you've got someone legit that will stand behind something like that. I think it's somewhat of a high-risk strategy, so you've got to be careful there. Just get a second opinion and make sure you're working with someone that, quote-unquote, is licensed and carries malpractice insurance so that they can stand behind their recommendation. No one at our office, Kirby, is an expert on that, and I'm not aware of someone. Also, you're going to want to make sure that the 1031 accommodation company you're working with is willing to go along with that, because they don't want exposure as well, if that's the strategy. Okay, we got a question over here from Ken in Illinois. He says, Mark, if I'm a full-time W-2 employee, can I also qualify for a full-time real estate professional and take advantage of the tax benefits that come with that designation? My understanding is that I must work a minimum of 15 hours per week, which is really a 750-hour per year, so it's kind of an average of 15 hours per week. Is it possible to do both? Thanks for the open forum. I always learn so much from your answers. Ken, thanks so much. Okay, well, let me put this in perspective for everybody listening. As many of you know, I talk about the purpose of buying rental property, not only to build long-term wealth, to create tax-free cash flow, but oftentimes there's tax write-offs because of depreciation and mortgage interest and all the little things that come with rental properties, including travel and property management, paying children. The rental property probably will lose money on paper, even though you're creating cash flow. Woo! So, do you get to take a write-off for those losses, for lack of a better word, on paper? Well, if you're not a real estate professional, oftentimes they're going to get capped and go into a carry-forward bucket, which, Ken, is still okay. That's me in my world. My wife nor I am a real estate professional. So my losses carry forward, and when I sell any sort of rental property, I may not need to do a 1031 exchange, which we just talked about, because I have these carry-forward losses, which is a great thing. So keep that in mind, that it's not the end of the world. Now, what Ken is alluding to here for everyone that may be new to this is that if you're a real estate professional, all of those losses are 100% deductible against your W-2 or any other sort of income. Huge! But to qualify, your full-time occupation has to be in real estate, and number two, you have to spend about 750 hours a year doing it. That's where Ken comes up with this 15 hours a week theory. Well, the issue, as Ken said, he has a day job with a W-2. He is going to fail on that first part of the test. Is his primary occupation in the real estate industry? And if he has a W-2 working full-time somewhere else, he's never going to get over that hurdle. Even if he spends 1,000 hours a year doing real estate, every night, every weekend he's doing real estate, the problem is his primary occupation is working for someone else. So, Ken, you're going to want to help the effort by getting your spouse, your wife, may qualify as the real estate professional. And if you're single, I want you hanging out at all the real estate realtor conferences, and I want you looking for that perfect real estate professional. She will be the love of your life and save you on your tax return. It's a perfect combination. You know, who says you can't, you know, have a perfect match on Match.com with a tax return? So there you go. So think about that. You may have to hit some of the clubs and bars with a note on yourself. Looking for a real estate professional, I have a day job. You could be a big catch for someone else. Okay, we also have a live caller here, and we're excited to have her on the line. So I'm going to bring her out. This is Gloria, and I think in Colorado, or with a property in Colorado. Gloria, welcome to the show.
Thank you. We recently sold a Colorado property owned in Colorado by let me start again. We recently sold a property in Colorado owned by our LLC. The title company required a copy of the LLC operating agreement. Then, noting that the LLC was owned by our revocable living trust, they wanted a complete copy of that. This happened also. We don't understand why they reached back and what we can do about it. It seems that the protection we were expecting evaporated.
Well, and this was the title company that wanted all this info?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I would. That's a great question, Gloria. And folks, I think this is good for other listeners to hear. Just because the title company wanted your blood type and a full physical and a copy of your trust, you know, your driver's license, and you know, you felt like you had to give them everything, that doesn't mean that the LLC didn't provide protection or still is providing protection regarding that property. The purpose of the LLC isn't to hide you or mean that you don't have to provide information to a title company or mortgage company or even a seller or buyer. It just means that if there's a problem on the property, so, and it could even be a latent defect. Let's say whoever you sold the property to gets mad because of a lot line problem, or there's some that they discover mold or asbestos in the walls and they want to sue you now. The LLC could still provide tremendous protection from you individually and personally. And so the LLC is still providing its serving its purpose, but giving the title company all that info is not thwarting your efforts. It just means they're a pain in the butt, and so be it. Does that help?
Yes. So you just live with their requests and provide them with their information.
Yeah, kind of a pain, but yeah, just live with it, and you're good to go. So
okay.
No major problems
there.
Hey, you bet. Thanks for calling in, Gloria. I love it. All right. Well, love a live caller there. And if you have a question also and you're listening live, you can type in your question on the chat line, and I'll try to pick that up as well. So, and if you want to email me now during the show, if I can get to it, I will get to your question as best I can. Let me make a couple quick announcements here since we're at the bottom of the hour. First, tomorrow. Some of you may already be signed up for this, but I'm doing a special one hour and a half webinar on healthcare. There are so many issues to address with Obamacare. The new November 15th enrollment period begins in just less than 2 weeks. You have 6 weeks to get your insurance in place. There's issues with the health savings account, the health reimbursement arrangement, how to pay yourself, how to get insurance as a deduction, how to get your healthcare expenses as a deduction. There are some incredible strategies. I spent 2 hours in a training last week myself, and I was blown away. I learned some new things, got some great tips, and I'm going to share them with you tomorrow night. So if you want to get on the webinar, please sign up for this Strategic Wealth Alliance webinar series. I put a lot of time and effort into it. It's a good hour and a half on my computer screen. I charge $20. And I do a new webinar every month. Next month is going to be year-end tax strategies, another popular webinar. And once you're in, you can watch all the old webinars. As soon as you watch the webinar, if you want to cancel, it's fine. But it's $20 a month and to stay on the webinar series. And again, you can cancel anytime and watch all the old webinars before you jump off. So think about that. It's going to be tomorrow night at 5 p.m. Pacific. And if you want to call in and talk to Justin to sign up, or go to my website, markjkohler.com, and just go to the Strategic Wealth Alliance webinar series under the product page or whatever, and you'll see it. So think about that. And then also Saturday, I'm going to be in Seattle doing a one-day workshop. I've got some new topics, some new jokes. Boy, I'm working harder on the jokes than the topics, I'll tell you. But it's going to be fun. We're going to have a great time in Seattle on Saturday. If you haven't signed up, it's a couple $100, $100 for your guest. I keep the cost down. I don't spend a lot of money advertising it through normal channels that really drives up the ticket price. I try to keep the cost down. And so it would be a fairly intimate group, probably 20 to 50 people at most. And a lot of you will be able to address all your questions and hang out there in Seattle. So if you're interested, give me a holler. We'll get you lined up for Saturday. Okay, we got another question here. This is from Karen. She says, can you or Matt Sorensen discuss exit strategies for my self-directed IRA LLC? So I've taken my IRA, formed an LLC, and I have a rental property inside the checkbook IRA LLC. I'm 54, and I want to start taking distributions when I'm 60. But I'd like to take the rental out of the IRA by then so I can reap the tax benefits of owning cash-flowing real estate. I also own another rental property outside of the IRA and want to eventually have that LLC buy the property from my IRA. Okay, two or three thoughts. if you ultimately, Karen, are going to take this property personally, so it sounds like you want to, in 6 years, have the property in your own name and just sit back and take the cash flow. Keep in mind, you've got two or three ways to do this. This is a really good question. And this brings up a killer strategy that may blow some of you away. One of the first things you can do is get the property appraised now at the lowest possible level. We'll take out any mortgage that you might have. Maybe you have no mortgage on it. That's fine. But whatever the equity is there, we get an appraisal and find out what it is. And let's convert your IRA to a Roth. So when you convert it to a Roth, you're going to pay taxes. Maybe we appraise it on December 31st, and we take part of it as Roth this year, and the other part of it is next year, because we get an appraisal that would work for both years. So now you're paying the tax now to convert it to a Roth. Now, here's what's cool. When you turn 59 and a half, age 60, you can just deed the property to yourself because you've already paid the tax on it. It's done. And any appreciation you've had between now and age 60 is tax-free. Also, any cash flow that accumulates in the Roth during this time between now and age 60 accumulates in your IRA LLC tax-free. So you're going to pay tax on the lower equity amount now, and then in 6 years, just deed it to yourself. Now, some of you may be thinking, going, whoa, how does this work? We have a lot of clients that do this with their retirement dream home. They're going to retire in 10 years or 15 years, so they buy a property now, have it as a rental, and then they know they're going to rehab it later, right when they're ready to retire. So they buy it in an area where they ultimately want to live. So they'll start converting it into a Roth along the way or buy it with a Roth. And then when they turn age 60, they deed it to themselves tax-free, do the rehab, there's their dream home. So a Roth would be a great strategy here, Karen. Another idea, Karen, is that when you turn 59 and a half or age 60, just take the cash flow as a distribution. It's penalty-free, and you'll pay tax on it. But if you take it out individually and then start collecting the cash, there's a good chance you're going to pay tax on that cash flow anyway. You may have depreciated the property by then, or you've already paid the tax on it, so you've just got this cash flow coming out. So whether you take the cash flow out of an IRA or you transfer it to your own name and take the cash flow, it might be taxable anyway. So why stress about it, taking the money out of an IRA slowly but surely when you turn 59 and a half, because there's no penalty. Anyway, just another thought. Okay, we're going to jump over to Akilah. This is a question on a 501c3, nonprofit. Ooh, boy, this is going to be a tough one. So is it possible to set up a 501c, that's a nonprofit, under my LLC and donate the profits and assets from my LLC to the 501c? So basically, Akilah is saying, I want to take my LLC assets and contribute it to a 1031, to a nonprofit, and sell the donated assets, and I on the tax on the gain, since the 501c3 is exempt. So I donate the property to the nonprofit, and then maybe sell it, and I wouldn't pay any tax on the gain. Then could the 501c use the profits donated from the LLC to pay myself a salary of the 501c? And then the same scenario, can I do it as a sole proprietor and donate everything to the 501c and then pay myself? Both would be to minimize self-employment tax and to pay no taxes on the capital gains. Akilah, let me give you one recommendation here. Charitable remainder trust. I know some of you were probably listening there getting your brain was about to explode, and it was a fairly confusing question, but I know exactly what Akilah is trying to do. And that is take these appreciated property, transfer it to a nonprofit, and create some cash flow. Well, that's called a charitable remainder trust. I've got some webinars on that on my webinar series. So Akilah, if you're going to tune in for the medical webinar tomorrow night, watch some of the older webinars on how to sell property without tax, and I do a whole section on the charitable remainder trust. That's probably where you want to be. But your question's huge, so I'm just going to leave it at that and keep moving along here in our amazing open forum show. Thanks for the great question. Okay, we've got Sandra here and asks, my questions are regarding estate planning. Let's say Tom has a traditional IRA of $400,000 and a beneficiary is a minor child. What choices will a minor have upon Tom's passing? Will either of these apply? The minor keeps the funds as a traditional IRA. The minor converts the funds to a Roth IRA. The minor takes distributions at the time of passing and have to pay income taxes. The second question, if Tom has a townhome as income property that has been taking depreciation, has a special warranty deed recorded that states that upon Tom's passing, the home goes to a minor child, will same inheritance tax rules apply upon distribution of the townhome, i.e. the townhome is inherited at value of the date of an inheritance, and no inheritance taxes for the first $5 million. Well, let me deal with the second question first. So if anybody out there has a deed and they want to modify the deed so it goes to a minor child when you die, there's not going to be any inheritance tax. The first $5 million, there's no inheritance tax, whether you run it through a will, run it through a weird special warranty deed, or through a trust. No inheritance tax. So that's easy. Now, would I want a minor child to get property like that? No. I think, Sandra, I would say a revocable living trust would be a very, very wise move. And do not do a special warranty deed that states this townhome goes to a minor child. Let's have it go into a trust and let the cash flow pay for college and let them grow up a little bit before you throw a townhome on them. Because I'll tell you, at age 18, they're going to dump the townhome and blow the cash. Happens every time. Well, I shouldn't say it every time. Some of you might have there an 18-year-old that money doesn't burn a hole in their pocket. Count yourself lucky. All right. Now, for the first question, she said, if a minor inherits an IRA, a traditional IRA worth $400,000, can they keep it as a traditional? Can they convert it to a Roth? Can they take it as a distribution over time? Well, the answer is they must take it as a well, they could take it in a lump sum and pay the tax, but they can't roll it into their own IRA or convert it to a Roth. They would have to take it as a lump sum or distribution over 5 years. That's generally the process. Now, I have to say, there's probably some financial plan out there with another idea or strategy on how the minor could take that money. So please forgive me, this is not my area of expertise. Get a second opinion before you make major decisions on this traditional IRA. But I will say this, one of the best things Tom could do is convert it to a Roth before the child inherits it. Then the child has a Roth IRA and can take out distributions anytime they want and continue to keep it as a Roth. The inheriting a Roth IRA is incredible. It's awesome. But inheriting a traditional IRA as a child, you don't have the same benefits as a spouse that inherits a traditional IRA. You can Google this and read up on it more. There's a lot of technical issues there, Sandra, so please, please forgive me. Woo, how are you guys doing? Cranking along here, huh? I hope you're having a wonderful fall afternoon. Little college football on the Saturdays and the crisp, cool air. I love this time of year, do too. And appreciate you putting up with these sometimes seemingly boring topics, but I am just passionate about this and I'm a dork, so I love it and I want to compliment you for staying in tune here on the show. All right. We've got another question here from Rokai. I apologize, I'm probably not saying it right. I am a CPA, though not as savvy as yourself. Oh, thank you so much. He says, we met at a Renatus event in Chicago in April of this year. Question one, I love multiple streams of income. I have an S-Corp I started for flipping houses. I have just started a direct sales business and would like to do some financial consulting as well. Can I run all of these out of my S-Corp? If so, how? I have the original company name and two DBAs. Well, Roka, this is a very doable procedure. Your S-Corp can have multiple sources of income and own multiple DBAs and own multiple URLs and just have people write the check to your S-Corp. Have people 1099 your S-Corp. Well, as you know, 1099s are required to be sent to a corp. But the point is, have people pay your S-Corp. In your QuickBooks, you would have multiple sources of income or classes, so you could track the revenue from these different sources. And so it's very doable. You don't have to you may want to change the purpose of the S-Corp at the state level, do a little amendment. You might even want to change the name of the S-Corp if it's not generic enough. But you're good to go. There's nothing major you need to do with the IRS by any means. Just tighten it up in your QuickBooks and maybe do an amendment at the state to give it a more general purpose and name. Question two, my husband is employed and I am self-employed. I am covered under his family insurance plan, which is a high deductible plan. We file a joint return and most of the medical bills are mine. Can I start my own HSA that is deductible on our joint return? If not, how should one be set up? Well, if you have a high deductible plan and it qualifies for an HSA, you betcha you can go open up an HSA on your joint return and take a tax deduction for that contribution. Absolutely. And Roka, you've got to listen to this little healthcare webinar tomorrow night. I'll give you a continuing education certificate for an hour and a half. Anybody that wants a continuing ed certificate, I'll give you one. You might be able to use it for your professional licensing. Because you might even want to do an HRA. We also want to make sure that any insurance that you're paying for pre-tax post-tax insurance that you're paying for out of your husband's company, we want to deduct that inside your self-employed business too. So there are a lot of options here, but the HSA is a good one. So to answer your question specifically, anybody out there, if you have a high deductible plan, making a contribution to your HSA on the joint tax return is very doable, and it is an awesome write-off. So another question from Ken here. He says, out in Illinois, he said, Mark, if we utilize your tax service for real estate investment property, do we also need a local CPA as well? Do you also prepare the personal returns? I reside in Illinois, and I'm buying my first two investment properties next month under my LLC. Can we help clients all over the country? You would not need a local CPA. And let me say this to everyone out there, though. We had a rough year. We had some turnover. We grew a lot, and it was just a rough year. And I know some of you were probably had a great experience at the accounting firm. Some of you maybe had a little rougher experience at the accounting firm. I want to tell you, I was very, very cognizant of those issues. We are we're doing a waiting list right now, and if we're not come January, we may tell those folks on the waiting list they're going to have to wait a little longer. But Ken, we would love to be of service. But we're going to grow a little more calculated this coming year. We've got a great team right now. We're circling the wagons. We're really training our staff right now to have a much more productive and better year in the accounting firm. So if any of you are listening and wonder, Mark, you just can't keep throwing new clients like fuel on a fire. We've got to slow down a little and take care of your team with some better customer service and turnaround time. That's our focus right now. And again, some of you had no problems at all. Some of you don't even know what I'm talking about. Some of you may have had a little bump in the road. Please send me an email. Let me know that you need a little extra TLC. Don't give up on me. Don't give up on my team. We're doing the best we can, and it's ugly out there. I have clients that go, Mark, I went out there, and I can't find a CPA that can communicate and give us a tax write-off for the life of me. And I know it's brutal out there. So we'll be there for you. Just be patient as we grow and try to work out our team. So, Ken, thank you for that. Okay, another question from Merrill. It says, Mark, if you open a California LLC and close it in less than a year, what will happen if one doesn't pay the $800 franchise tax? Since the LLC is closed, what is California's recourse? Does it increase the chance of an audit? Can they go after me personally? Well, Merrill, with several thoughts. First of all, if you open and close the LLC quickly and don't even use it, you can send a letter and request abatement where they don't charge the $800. And I've seen clients, and we've written letters for clients, and got them out of the $800 franchise tax because the company wasn't even used. It was open quickly and closed quickly. Next, if you don't pay it and they don't abate it, it certainly can increase your chance of an audit because they're pissed and they might want to come look at you personally for not paying that fee. Could they come after you personally? They say they can, but I'll just tell you right now that we're not seeing that. The state is going after the LLCs. If you want to reinstate the LLC, you have to pay the fee. And some people have to reinstate an LLC for a variety of reasons, and so the state ultimately gets paid. But they are not piercing the veil or holding the managers or the owners personally liable for that $800 as of right now. Now, there could be cases out there where they are. I just haven't heard it. So be careful. Don't take that as gospel that they couldn't do it, but we currently are not seeing them go after you personally. I would suggest you go for the letter, try to get the $800 waived, stay in touch with them, beg of them and say, please work with me. Getting on the phone is futile. They're brutal on the phone, getting a hold of someone, what I mean. So write the letters and go that route. Okay, let's see. We've got a live caller here with a question with the amazing name of Mark. So it's a 1031 exchange question as well. So let's bring him out here on the line. Mark, you there?
Hey, Mark. Mark Hubshard down in San Diego. How are you today?
Good. Mark, thanks for calling in. Good to hear your voice. I appreciate it.
Yes, sir. So I've got a number of properties in the Go Zone, Louisiana specifically, that was bought after the Go Zone initiative. One of the neighborhoods has changed in character and is tougher to rent, so we've been thinking of doing a lease purchase there to accelerate filling it up, but I don't want to be characterized as an installment sale with the accelerated depreciation. I want to still be able to do a clean 1031. So how would I structure something like that?
Well, okay, so I'm going to restate the questions just so I can gather my thoughts here too. So you have a highly appreciated property in an area that's tough to just sell it outright. So your buyers would have to do a lease option or do an installment purchase where you're going to carry the paper.
I'd rather keep it as a rental, but sometimes we have extended vacancy in that neighborhood, so I'm trying to fill it up with at least a lease option and give me time to plan a 1031 out the backside of it instead of just vacant.
Okay. Well, the character of that question changed dramatically where it's a little easier answer for me. Thank you.
Oh, okay.
So with a lease option, I agree. If you have a tough property you're trying to rent it and get quality tenants, going to a lease option like Mark's suggestion here is a great idea. You can get a higher quality tenant. They look at it as potentially their ultimate home, so they take better care of it. I love it. Go for it, Mark. And the 1031 doesn't kick in until they exercise the option. Now, you may want to put in that lease agreement that says, hey, I'll give you some equity with your rental payment. You've got this lease option opportunity. And when you exercise the option, I am not going to pay. You got to go get your own loan, but I'll give you some built-in equity. And you can even designate a future appraisal, or you could designate a purchase price now. But once they exercise the option, that's when the 1031 clock would start ticking. And if you're going to carry the paper, it's really difficult. You would be stuck in an installment sale. But if you're willing to, if you can help them get into their own loan and cash you out, that's when the 1031 can happen.
But until then, it's
just a lease option.
For us, it's finance. So we would want them to pay off our financing with their new, but if we give them equity along the way, that's not characterized as an installment sale along the way?
Right, it is not. It's a lease with an option to purchase. And then, and a lot of times in most states, you do the lease separate from the option contract. So the option contract would say, I want some down payment. I'll give you 10 or 20% credit on all your rent payments towards the purchase price. If you don't exercise it or you default on the lease, I keep all your money. But if you do follow through and you keep the contract tight and you follow through, that day when you actually buy it is when the sale takes place and the 1031 clock starts. So until then, it's just a renter. It's just a renter with a lease option on the side.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for making the question easier at that point, too. Well, good luck, man. I love it.
Thanks very much. Bye.
Thanks, Mark. All right, talk to you later. All right, so we've got Rick now down in Minnesota. I think Rick in Minnesota is experiencing a little different weather than Mark down in San Diego. But Rick in Minnesota, is it too late to start a business this year to claim on taxes? It is a tech support small business, support business. I have helped several businesses this year and have income less than $2,000, although I have quite a bit of startup expenses. And love the show. Thanks, Rick. Let me say, it is not too late. I love this. Rick, this is a great way to take some write-offs this year, and that is to take this less than $2,000 income, and maybe over the next 2 months it's a little higher. I don't know. But let's take that $2,000 as income, and let's write off some of those startup costs. You may drum up $5,000 to $7,000, maybe $8,000 or $9,000 worth of expenses. I have to say, Rick, it depends on the look of your overall return. I don't know if I want to take too many expenses and create a red flag for an audit because you write off too much. So please be careful with that. But definitely you've got a small business. We need to take some write-offs. You should have a loss, and it's going to help reduce the taxes on your other income. So go for it. Love it, Rick. Great question. Gosh, one of our last questions here. I think, well, there's a few more that got emailed in. If I didn't get to it, we'll see if we can quickly do this. This is Andrew. He said, Mark, I recall your class where you said the focus is for us to know when to contact an attorney or CPA. I have a question. I took a representative position with a steel company out of China. They have clients in the U.S. and Canada. One of their clients I was sent in his first payment on invoicing from the company. I am supposed to deposit it. However, it's not my funds, and I don't want to be taxed on $103,000 paid. The check is made out to me, representative of this company. Do I get an entity to funnel the funds through to the main company, like an S-Corp or something? Andrew, my initial reaction is, if you're a representative for this company you're assisting, and one of the clients paid you incorrectly, frankly, and there's no way to have them reissue the check, you turn around and deposit the check and turn around and write a check to the main company, and in a sense, you're going to 1099 them. So that way, in the eyes of the IRS, the $103,000 came in, the $103,000 went out, and you're not taxed on it, and you would 1099 the main company. I don't think you need an S-Corp or something. I'm not sure how you're getting paid in general if you are on salary or if you have other income. But, Andrew, a consult may make sense. There's a lot of zeros involved in what you're talking about, and we want to make sure you're covered. But you would deposit the funds and turn around and pay this other company if it's not your money anyway. And then that way you wouldn't be taxed on it. I'm going to jump over to Michelle here. I love her little question here in the last 2 to 3 minutes. She says, if I am deducting a portion of a trip as a business trip, should I pay on the company card and reimburse the company for my personal expenses, or should I pay with my personal card and have the company reimburse me for the business portion, or does it even matter? Michelle, what I would probably do, and this is good for everybody out there, if you're traveling and you are traveling for business, and yet there might be some personal benefits here. And so you don't want to be too aggressive and write off the entire trip as business and be cautious. I would still pay for it with the business checkbook or the business debit card. And then when you go to record it or you let your accountant know, say, hey, guess what? 20% of that trip was really personal, or 30% or 40%, whatever the balance of that is that's personal. Just let your CPA make an adjustment on the books at the end of the year when you do the tax return. I think it would make the easiest sense to make an adjustment in the books and just let the company pay for your travel. Folks, that's what I do too. If I'm on the road, now if there's a portion of the trip that is obviously personal, I can just pay for that with a personal debit card while I'm on the trip. But for the big expense of the airfare and hotel, rental cars, I'll let the business pay for it. And if I feel it's necessary, I can back out a little bit as a personal expense so I don't overdo it. Okay, now I need to make this quick announcement. Next week, we have an amazing guest. I think you guys are going to love her. She's been on the show once before, but it's been several years. She has only continued to get more and more popular around the country. It's Cappy Pidwell. She is an expert in human behavior as a master of NLP, that's called neuro-linguistic programming, and advanced hypnotherapy, and she helps people increase their sales, increase their wealth consciousness, their self-esteem, their confidence, their communication. This is huge. There's so many things she can help you do better in business. She's a wonderful guest and so fun to listen to. And I just encourage all of you next week to please tune in for another round of the Mark Kohler Show, and we're going to have Kathy Pidwell talking about increasing sales and your confidence and your success as a business owner. Folks, keep living the dream. Don't give up. And I'm so grateful that you're here with me. We'll have a next month will be the open forum show. Please send in your questions. You can see the notes. And I hope to see more of you at a live workshop or a webinar in the future. Thanks so much. Love you. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to another hour of refreshing strategies to better live your American dream.
Don't forget to get your free copy of Mark and Matt's ebooks and sign up for their weekly free newsletter with important tax deadlines and articles at refreshyourwealth.com.